Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. In this edition of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Rabbi Alex Hull, who is the author of a number of books. The first one was The Challenge of Jewish History. I'll just read the title, The Bible, the Greeks, and the Missing 168 Years. The second one was Searching for Sinai, the Location of Revelation, so where Har Sinai is. And the third one, and the most recent, which will be the focus of our talk today, is Pharaoh, Biblical History, Egypt, and the Missing Millennium, talking about who the Pharaoh and the Pharaoh was in the Torah. So I just want to mention this podcast is being generously sponsored by a friend of the show. And he told me to say he's sponsoring it in honor of Shirley Borenstein, who introduced him to this Sfarim Chatter podcast. I just want to mention that. Okay, so with that, thank you very much, Rabbi Hull, for joining me.
Thank you very much for allowing me to this opportunity to say a few words on this topic.
My pleasure. So I think we should start off, tell the listeners a little bit of a brief background about yourself.
I'm English born. I was born in London. I was brought up in a town, Kingsbury. It's part of a group of the United Synagogues. It's belonged to the group of United Synagogues. My father was a Rav there for many years. Thriving community. Many of the people who have actually moved on to either Eretz Yisrael or to other communities. That's where I was brought up. I went to school in London and Hashmonaim and Menorah. And then I went to Yeshiva Gateshead for a number of years, for 5 years in Yeshiva Gateshead. And then I moved to Bnei Brak to study in Ponovich. And I basically got married there a few years after I arrived in Ponovich, and have been there since, but in yeshiva, and then on into the kollel.
Okay, very nice. So as I mentioned at the beginning, you wrote a couple of books, and mainly they deal with chronology, and you know, from sources, and also obviously secular ones together. How you fix it in, you know, the discrepancies in Chazal and general history, and we'll get more into this, but. Well, it's, you know, it's an interesting, very unique topic, very interesting. What drew you to this topic? Was that something always interested you? When did you just decide to start writing about this and researching this?
Well, it started off, I had a friend who actually looked into the matter. He heard about the problem. It's an age-old problem, the missing years with relation to the second Beis Hamikdash is actually a discrepancy between secular chronology and Divrei Chazal, as it would appear, and that of a discrepancy of actually 168 years, which is quite enormous. And this friend of mine spent a number of years investigating the evidence in support of the secular chronology. And he discussed it with me, and he presented to me a précis of all that evidence and all that work which he did. And I was intrigued to find such an enormous amount of seemingly solid and authentic evidence which seemingly supported the secular chronology. And therefore I was intrigued that how could this possibly be? We know that our heritage, our Masorah is so precise, the deliberation of the sages in ascertaining the truth in any field is unparalleled throughout history. Could it be that there's some kind of mass amnesia set into the Jewish people that they could forget 168 years of their own history? So I was basically intrigued by the two sides, which seemed so powerful. But I thought this must be able to lead to a solution to the problem, because the clearer you are, the more authentic evidence you have, that can be a direction to discover the truth. And there must be an answer to this problem. And therefore, I decided to invest time and energy in trying to understand what happened.
And then that led you to research the Har Sinai and then the current book about the Pharaoh?
Yes, basically one thing led to another. Someone came over, Jim Long, who read the first book, he came over and presented me his book on the Exodus, the riddle of the Exodus, and he had a chapter there, an appendix about the identity of Har Sinai. And at the time I was working on Gevulas Haaretz, the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, and it was relevant to the location of Kodesh Barnea, which also has relevance to Har Sinai. And I thought that perhaps the knowledge and the identity of Har Sinai might lead to the identity of Kodesh Barnea, and which would have halachic implications with regarding the Gevulas Haaretz. And that got me basically into the looking for the site of Har Sinai.
Right, and then you got to the current book, which is on Parai, on Pharaoh, in the Torah, which is, we're recording this on Hanukkah, which is Parashas Miketz. It's already, we're already discussing the Parai, the Pharaoh, so it already, it's relevant, very relevant to a large portion of the Torah. So what's the basic premise of the book? I think a lot of people probably will be familiar with the story, with Parai, was there one, two, you know, various sort of parts of the story, but maybe not be familiar with structures of the Egyptian pharaohs and who was and what happened. So why don't you maybe lay out the basic groundwork a little bit?
Right. Well, basically, the premise of the book is actually twofold. There were two points to the book and two elements of the book. One element is a continuation of the history timeline. We, in the first, the challenge of Jewish history, we try to establish the true timeline of history from the Second Temple period up until the present day. In the next book, the Pharaoh book, we continued back in time from the Second Temple period, going all the way back to the birth of the state of Egypt. And in that way, we basically encompassed the whole of world history from the flood all the way to the present day. So that was one part of the book in order to be able to establish, to demonstrate the synthesis and the harmonization with the conclusions of the challenge of Jewish history, which contracts secular chronology by 168 years, and to show that this contraction of history can be maintained in the period before the Second Temple, all the way back to the birth of the state of Egypt. That was one element of the book. Another element of the book is to identify the pharaohs of the Tanakh. The Pasuk constantly in the Torah and in Nevi'im refers to Pharaoh. The Pharaoh was a royal name. It wasn't his personal name. And so we don't have direct information from the Torah or Nevi'im who the different pharaohs actually were and when they lived. And so the purpose of the book there was to discuss and to find through the archaeological evidence which we have through the guided by, of course, the Psukim and Divrei Chazal, to be able to locate the period in history where these kings existed and the actual identification of these various pharaohs.
Okay, so I think maybe best to start from there before we get into actually the nitty-gritty, so to speak, of the book. What would be a quick basic overview of the Egyptian dynasties? You know, what is the dynasty? What does that refer to? How many are there? You know, and the basic ones, I think, what we're going to be talking about, the time period. And, you know, throughout that, I think people are familiar with maybe Ramses being a pharaoh, name that they heard of at the time. I think just give a basic structure, basic, you know, overview for people.
Right, yes. It is very important when one is looking into Egyptian history to know how it's the format of Egyptian history in modern times. Scholars have divided up Egyptian history into separate dynasties. What that means very simply is that the kings, one king ruled after another, and the scholars have divided up groups of kings into what they call as dynasties. Basically, they've divided up the whole of the Egyptian era from its very beginning till the time of the Second Temple period, into 31 dynasties. That means 31 groups of kings, which they believe followed one after another, one dynasty after another. Each dynasty was made up of about 8 or 9 kings, depending on where they put the scholars of today or modern day scholars, or basically on, from Greek historians, how to divide up the groups of kings into dynasties. But more or less, each dynasty is 7 or 8 kings, generally speaking. Now, that is the dynastic era, and that is guided all scholars in analyzing Egyptian history, is referring and relating to the different dynasties. Now, with regard to the identification of Paro of Mitzrayim, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, basically what scholars have done is they've worked back in time. We know that Darius, who built the second Beis HaMikdash, he was the son of Esther, according to Divrei Chazal. He was referred to by in the secular world as Darius the Great. It is universally accepted that Darius the Great built the second temple, and he was part of the 27th dynasty of Egypt, because he actually ruled in Egypt as well, and therefore he was one of the rulers of the 27th dynasty. So basically, in order to discover who the Pharaoh of Egypt was at the time of the Exodus, we have to work back from Darius, from the 27th dynasty, following simply the years of the Bible, to the time of the Exodus. And we do have direct information from the Bible how many years expired from the Exodus until the Second Temple. That is as follows. We know the Pasuk tells us that the Beis HaMikdash HaRishon was built 480 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. Then working through the kings, the reigns of the kings, which are recorded in Tanakh of the kings of Yehuda and the kings of Yisrael, direct us according to the interpretation of Chazal and indicated by the Psukim, 410 years for the period of the first Beis HaMikdash. And then we have the 70 years of Golus, also referred to in Novi. And therefore, that by adding those years, going back the 70 years of Golus, and then the 410 years of the first temple period, and then a further 480 years will take us back to the Yetzias Mitzrayim. So we have almost 1,000 years of history to be able to work back from Darius in order to get to Yetzias Mitzrayim. So we then go to the Egyptian chronologists, and we follow 1,000 years of history going back from Darius until we arrive at the period in time where the Exodus should be, according to the Divrei Chazal. Accordingly, what happens is that the scholars discovered a problem, a very serious problem. The problem was that following this method will take us basically back to the 18th dynasty, somewhere in the beginning, in the middle of the 18th dynasty. Now, we have another clue to the Pharaoh of the Exodus, which doesn't seem to fit in to this basic premise. And that is that the Klal Yisrael left the land of Ramses. They left the land of Ramses. Now, the earliest mention of the name Ramses comes from the 19th dynasty. There was a king, a number of kings called Ramses, and the assumption is that the name of the country Ramses, where Klal Yisrael left, was probably called after the king Ramses. And the king Ramses who we have records of only existed from the 19th dynasty. And the 19th dynasty is much further forward in time than the 1,000 years going back to the 18th dynasty. So we've already been cut short. We have a contradiction here between the Bible and Egyptian chronology. So scholars have opted for Egyptian, for the definition that Ramses must be the pharaoh because that country must be named after him. So the pharaoh of Egypt must be in the 19th dynasty. And although the Bible seems to say the opposite, we'll opt for Egyptian chronology and say that our information tracking the Egyptian dynasties is correct. And we'll have to try and interpret the verses of the Torah and of the Tanakh differently.
Right, and I guess that's where your book steps in to try to explain, according to Chazal, how, and according to the Tanakh, how we can fit this in. So I think the first thing that we should really address is, so what are the strengths and weaknesses of the conventional dating once we're getting into, you know, discussing actually dating over here?
Right, well, that's a very good point. There are strengths in, of course, there are in secular chronology, but there are weaknesses as well. I mean, everyone who has approached the history analysis realizes that history is a recondite field of research where there is always the element of the unknown and there is always the part which one has to leave to conjecture. That is a general problem in any subject of history. Generally speaking, the information which has guided scholars, modern day scholars, is tremendous, but it is concentrated on the infrastructure of the singular dynasties themselves. Within the dynasties themselves, we have very, very strong evidence of one king ruling after another, and even the length of reign. But how the dynasties correlate with each other is not as strong as people think. It is a lot based on conjecture, and therefore this can lead to drastic changes in the whole structure of Egyptian chronology. If there's a mistake in joining, for example, the sixth dynasty with the seventh dynasty, then that can cause a contraction of history. Sometimes we can find indication that dynasties overlap with each other, and therefore what scholars may have believed rightly so, that each dynasty reigned for a certain amount of time, but not knowing when they followed on one from the other, that can cause a contraction of history of several hundred years.
Right, which is fascinating. So I think your book, it starts off in the beginning of the book, it discusses, you know, dating it, using various astronomical data. So I think just to explain what we're referring to with astronomical data over here and the different system the Egyptians use. I know you refer to different dating systems, I think, in the beginning of the book.
Right. I think it's a very strong, the backbone of Egyptian chronology is actually using astronomical information, which is very strong because it's authentic. It's something which scholars have used. It wasn't governmental documentation. It was astronomical observations, which we can retrocalculate to understand when these observations were seen and therefore date accordingly. Now, the backbone of Egyptian chronology is based on a series of sightings throughout Egyptian history, which has formed a method called Sothic dating. Basically, it was common in throughout the dynastic era to celebrate the rising of the dog star Sirius, and this took place, and this was recorded at a certain time of the year. Now, the Egyptian calendar It was a very simple calendar, not like the Julian calendar, which we have 365 and a quarter days in order to maintain the solar year. The Egyptian calendar only had 365 without the quarter. And therefore, every 4 years, the Egyptian calendar will slowly disalign itself with the seasonal year, because the seasonal year is 365 and a quarter days, whereas the Egyptian calendar year is only 365 days. And therefore, the months, the Egyptian months, in the course of time, will basically be dragged throughout the seasonal year. So if we have a place in a date on a certain king in a certain dynasty, where he records the recording of the Cyrus in a certain month, and we know when that month was in the seasonal year, we can work out when that date was actually recorded in history, and therefore this allows us to be able to pinpoint the exact place when that dynasty took place. So basically, we have a number of recordings of this dog star. It's actually a relative chronology. It's not an absolute chronology. It's basically, it's with relation to the different dynastic eras. So we have a sighting in the 12th dynasty. We have a sighting in the 18th dynasty. We have sightings in the 27th dynasty. And that gives us information to determine the relative amount of years between the 12th dynasty and the 18th dynasty, and the 18th dynasty and the 27th dynasty. And that forms the backbone of Egyptian structure. And after that, the scholars have filled in the gaps between the 12th and the 18th, and the 18th and the 27th dynasty. Now, recently, this system seems to be very strong, has become into question because another series of astronomical observations, not connected with the Sothic dating, but connected with the sighting of the lunar month from the 12th dynasty, a series of dates when set in the system set out by the conventional chronology using the Sothic dating and based on the premise of history, which Egyptian history is based on, they have found a discrepancy, because the sightings of these lunar months do not fit in with the positioning of the 12th dynasty following Sothic dating. A number of years ago, a scholar discovered a period in history where these lunar dates can be harmonized and synchronized. Now, it's 39 lunar dates. The possibility of finding a matching period is extremely unlikely. And if this period has been found, this would seem to be close to Vadai, that this is the period when they were written. Now, we discovered that this period, which has now been discovered, which finds reconciliation for the lunar dates by just shifting the whole of the Egyptian period without changing the Sothic system of the number of years between each dynasty, for example, the 12th and the 18th, and the 18th and 27th, just shifting the whole period 150 years or so further forward in time, this will produce perfect harmonization with the lunar dates. What this means is that Egyptian chronology is correct between the 18th dynasty and the 27th dynasty. In fact, we have discovered that more or less year correct chronology from the 18th dynasty all the way up to the end of the dynastic era. If year exact chronology, but it has to be all pushed 150 years or so forward in time.
And the premise for doing so is merely because that makes everything work better, or there's that, or are there any other reason to do so, to push it forward? I'm just trying to understand.
Yes, because to be able to synchronize the Sothic dating in any period in history is remote. To be able to synchronize a Sothic period, which also matches with the lunar dates, it makes it all the more, the lunar dates themselves, to be able to have such matching for the period which has been found is remote, to say the least. But to have such synchronization also with the Sothic system, it just spells out scientifically that this must be the true period in history when they were written. Otherwise, it can't be by chance that they had such synchronization between the Sothic dating, which is an authentic process, and the lunar dating, which is also an authentic observation. And if they both direct to the same period in time precisely, so we surely have scientific evidence that this is the period of dating Egyptian chronology.
Right, okay. And I, just to clarify, I'm sure for myself and I'm sure the listeners as well. So what's interesting here is, like you said, we're using the astronomical data, and that's why we're verifying everything. It's not just like historical records that they saw, you know, it was year one versus year this, right? Because you're using the actual astronomical data.
Absolutely. And that is a vital clue. History is full of documentation. Now, documentation is dangerous because when it's written by people who we have no idea how honest they were. In fact, we have a great idea of how dishonest the nations of the world were. And most, as Isaac Newton already pointed out, throughout the history, the nations of the world, they reformed their antiquities. They changed antiquities all to glorify their political reasons, their achievements throughout history. So it is very dangerous to be able to use history documentation. But when you have scientific information like astronomical observations, and we find mathematical matching, you can't argue with mathematics. This is a scientific as history can get.
Right, absolutely. So I took you a little off track. So now that we're moving, we're shifting those 150 years, where does that actually leave us in regards to the subject matter of the book, back to the dynasties and the pharaoh? Where do we, and the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus, where does that leave us now?
Okay, so basically, establishing that this as we said, that's really the first element of the book, to show actually that this actually coincides with the conclusions of the challenge of Jewish history. Basically, the conclusions of the challenge of Jewish history is that the Persian era has been misplaced 168 years further back in time. So if we basically push forward the Persian era into its right position, following the conclusions of the first book, basically we're pushing the whole of history, which was before the Persian era, also more or less 168 years in time, which is actually now conforming perfectly with the discovery of the harmonization of the Sothic dating with the series of lunar dates, which also dictates shifting the whole of Egyptian history forward 150 years or so. So with regard to the element of the general history of the world, it's demonstrating the accuracy on the one hand of Egyptian chronology from the 18th dynasty all the way to the Second Temple period. We can now confirm that extreme accuracy. And we also can confirm the conclusions of the challenge of Jewish history, that the 168 years of the Persian era actually coincided with the Greek era. And that is the answer to the problem of where this 168 year discrepancy has been created. It's been created because the period of Persian era has existed. There were Persian kings, but it has been pushed back from being coexisting with the Greek era. It has been pushed back 168 years and basically creating a whole new period of history, by a whole new period of 168 years of history, and pushing back the whole of world history from before the Persian era as well. Now we are bringing down the Persian era. We are now following that with this new book, with the Pharaoh book, bringing down the Egyptian era all the way back into its right period in time with respect to the common era. But that gets us now to basically to be able to define simply who the Pharaoh of the Exodus is. We can now follow the Divrei Chazal, the Psukim of the Torah, and be able to go back and now look at the precise date which is dictated by the Torah, by the Divrei Chazal, for the Exodus, and look to see who was there in Egyptian chronology. We know, following the Torah, following Nach, following Divrei Chazal, that the Exodus, Yetzias Mitzrayim, took place in 1311 BCE. 1311 BCE, following now Egyptian chronology, which we have confirmed, the relative chronology of Egyptian chronology, going back from Darius all the way back to the 18th dynasty, in fact, takes us to an 18th dynasty king. The 18th dynasty king was Thutmose. His name was Thutmose. It's very fascinating that when we start looking into the information we have of Thutmose, we suddenly see a tremendous indication that indeed Thutmose was the king at the time of the Exodus. There is a queen who was his aunt, who actually took over the kingdom in his early years of Thutmose. She refers in an inscription to a wandering people that exited Egypt after causing its ruination. A wandering people who exited recently and caused the ruination of Egypt, and she claimed that she was the one who rebuilt Egypt after this destruction of these people. Now, at the time, following our information from the Torah, when this inscription was written, Klal Yisrael were wandering in the Midbar during the 40 years of Golas. So here we have a precise reference to the whole of the Jewish people who left the north of Egypt. She actually refers to the north of Egypt. We know Goshen is in the north of Egypt. And she refers to it, and she refers to the exodus of these people after they caused the ruination of Egypt. So that's one indication from Thutmose. Now, we have another fascinating piece of information. We know there were 10 plagues in Egypt. So the 10 plagues, one would think, is it possible that there could be some kind of remnants of the 10 plagues still existent today? Well, there is only one plague where that could be possible, and that is the plague of boils, because the boils affected the bodies of the Egyptians. Now, we know that the Egyptians mummified bodies. They had a way of preserving the bodies and keeping them intact for thousands of years. Do we have any bodies from that period in time that might be able to show us indications of the plague of boils? Well, indeed we have. In the 18th dynasty, there was Thutmose, as we mentioned, and they have the body of Thutmose, the mummified body of Thutmose today. Recently, actually, as in the beginning of the last century, it was actually analyzed, and later on, in 20 or so years ago, there was a much more sophisticated equipment to be able to study these bodies. And the recordings were that the body of Thutmose is covered in scars of boils throughout the body. Now, this phenomena was found not only on the body of Thutmose, but also on his aunt, which we mentioned earlier, and also a nanny of Thutmose, who was totally unrelated to Thutmose. So scholars have confirmed that this wasn't something genetic. It was a disease which affected the court of Pharaoh, and it was a very severe disease. They also found that Thutmose the third's father, it wasn't his biological father, but Thutmose the second died as a young man, and he's covered in severe boils. And the indication is that he actually died from the boils themselves, because of the, we see from the other bodies that in the course of time they began to get better, but that this particular body remained the same. So it would indicate that he actually died from the boil. So we have here three different mummies, all showing us this signs of boils, which just fits into the plague of boils at the time of the Exodus, which is quite incredible.
Yeah, fascinating. So we'll get back to more of this in a second. I forgot to ask something. Now that we moved the years, though, when we're fixing everything around, is there any corroboratory archaeological evidence that fits with this movement of the years? Obviously, things are going to shift now.
Yes, it is. In fact, this answers a tremendous amount of questions. A number of years ago, about 20 years ago, a series of scholars investigated the whole of world history and discovered great voids in the civilizations of the world, the different civilizations of the world, which unexplainable voids of history, and all based on the dynastic era of Egypt. Basically, the problem they found is that the Mycenaean era was the generations before the Greeks, before the early Greeks, was known as the Mycenaeans. And the Mycenaeans had connection with the Egyptian dynastic era. Now, dating the dynastic era in line with the secular chronology has set the Mycenaean era about 300 years between them and the Greeks. Yet the Mycenaeans were meant to be the founders of the Greek era. So there's a great void between the Mycenaeans and the Greeks. Now, it's not only in Greek history, because the Mycenaeans also interrelated to the other civilizations. For example, even Europe, the prehistoric Europe, they had in connections with the Mycenaeans. And then there's a great void of industrial activity until we come to the Greek era, which was several hundred years later. So what happened in these dark ages? And they've gone through every civilization and showing that a particular time in history, we've got it roughly 200 years or so of just voids of nothing. And yet there's continuity on both sides of the civilizations. Now, once we shift the Egyptian era 150 years or so forward in time, basically we're closing all those gaps. We're joining up the Mycenaeans with the Greeks and with the rest of the civilizations, and basically it disappeared all the black areas, all the gray areas of the different civilizations just disappear into the thin air.
A related question, but a different topic, but I guess it's just worth asking. I'm sure people, how do you view, in general, using archaeological data, various archaeological data with, learning the Torah?
That's a very interesting question. I think we see from Rishonim that they valued authentic evidence. The Rambam had a view about measuring the coin, the size of the coin, and from the Gemara. And he discovered a single coin when he came to Eretz Yisrael, and based on that information from that coin, for the archaeological discovery of that coin, he changed his view of the weight of the coin brought down in Chazal, and that had obviously halachic ramifications. Once the Ramban was convinced of the authenticity of the archaeological find, he had no problem in using it in understanding the Torah. That is definitely true. We have to be careful, though. We have our Masorah. Anything which is Masorah, that is passed down from sage to sage, that is unchallengeable. It has never been challenged throughout our history, the Masorah itself. But not everything is given over to Masorah. Sometimes it's given to interpretation. Interpretation we can have new information, and we can use that authentic information to try and understand psukim, understand Divrei Chazal much better if we have more information. We have to be able to distinguish when we have a question of interpretation and we can use valid, authentic evidence, and when we have a question of Masorah, which has never been challenged throughout our history.
Okay, so that's that. So getting back to what we were saying before, so we referenced Tutmos that he lived at the time of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus, but to clarify, I think you meant is that he was not actually the Pharaoh who was in charge at the time of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, at the time of the Makkah. So obviously that I think there's somebody else. So you want to talk more about that?
Yes, that's right. What we said was we discovered that Tutmos lived at the time of the Exodus. In fact, he was a king at the time of the Exodus. But was he the oppressor? Apparently, no. He was not the oppressor. He was a king. But what we have discovered, that evidently Egypt at the time was actually divided up into a number of kingdoms. In fact, they actually indicated in Tehillim, where the Pasuk refers to as the Malchim Mitzrayim, as the Malchim Mitzrayim, that means there were more than one king of Egypt at the time. What actually happened was as follows. As we said, from the 18th dynasty, basically the conventional chronology is almost year perfect. With respect to before the 18th dynasty, there's much more shaky information which scholars have been guided by, and very, very weak information, very, very weak links between the dynasties. What we discovered is basically the first to the sixth dynasty led up all the way to the Exodus. What that means is that the sixth dynasty was actually coexisting with the 18th dynasty. The pharaoh of the oppressors were actually the kings of the sixth dynasty. They reigned in the north. They were part of the Hyksos. Anyone who's studied a bit of Egyptian history will have heard about the Hyksos. They began their period of reign, according to the Greek historians, it's several hundred years they reigned over Egypt. They were foreign kings. We know from Targum Yonis and Ben Uziel, at the time of Avraham Avinu, when he came down to Egypt, in the time of the famine, he actually spoke to the Pharaoh, who was not a native Pharaoh, but he was actually the son of Nimrod. So here we have the first mention of a foreign king, actually a Hyksos king, as a king of Egypt at the time of Avraham Avinu. And basically, from the time of Avraham until the Exodus was roughly 430 years, and therefore that basically is the precise amount of time of the Hyksos reign in Egypt. And so that finished, that period of Hyksos went through from the 16th dynasty is referred to as the 16th dynasty, and the 5th and the 6th dynasty were all the Hyksos rulers, and the last king was a king who reigned for 1 year. In Egyptian history, this is recorded as a king who reigned for 1 year. And indeed, Sadir Olam tells us that the king, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, reigned for 1 year. And we have other information which directs us to supporting that the sixth dynasty kings were the oppressors of Egypt at the time of the Exodus.
Mm-hmm. So even though it's the 6th and 18th, you're saying the dynasty, just to clarify for myself, those were at the same time, even though the numbers are so far off, right?
So what we're basically, if you want to do it in a nutshell, if you want to place the whole of Egyptian history in a nutshell, the way it worked is it worked from 1 to 6. It was actually consecutive dynasties, the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th dynasty. And then from the 18th dynasty, it was also consecutive till the way the 31st. But basically the 7th to the 17th dynasty were actually coexisting between the 3rd dynasty and the 6th dynasty. So that's how all the dynasties fit together. But okay, on one leg, one can't explain all the evidence to support that. But there is a tremendous amount. It's not based on, you know, just shifting around. It's based on forced implications from all the archaeological evidence that there is.
Right. Absolutely. So first of all, what was his name, according to what you've researched? So what was the name of this pharaoh at the time of the Egyptian Triumph?
Neferkhair. His name was Neferkhair, I believe. He was he was the son of Pepi the Second, and he reigned for 1 year. Pepi the Second reigned for a number of years, and he was the main oppressor. He was actually the brother of Busparu, and the king before that was the king Pepi the First, was the father of Busparu. And so basically the Shibud of Mitzrayim, the great oppression, was carried out by Pepi the First and then followed up by Pepi the Second. It was Pepi the Second who tried to kill Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu had to flee. It actually comes out from basically gathering all the sources that Moshe Rabbeinu, we actually have, what happened was that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was adopted by Basia, Chazal tell us that he was taken away from his house at the age of 12. Now we can understand what that means. What that means is what actually happened was, we know from Greek historians that the king of the Exodus, the Bastia, the daughter of Bastia Basparu, who was the daughter of the Pharaoh during the time of the oppression, was she married a certain king, and this king was in the south, and so Bastia Basparu moved to the south at the time when Moshe Rabbeinu was 12 years old. And he stayed there with Basia until he was 40 years old. And when he was 40 years old, just at the time when Pepi the First died, and evidently this was the time when there was no danger for Moshe Rabbeinu to come back, because don't forget, there was worry here that the Pharaoh was given information that the Messiah of the Jewish people had been born. And he had suspicions that maybe Moshe Rabbeinu was actually the Messiah. And that's why he did the famous test with the coals. So once he adopted Pharaoh's daughter, Bastia Basparu, adopted Moshe Rabbeinu, evidently his fears were allayed. But if Moshe Rabbeinu would come back and start inquiring about the Jewish people, that would spark his worries off once again. So Moshe Rabbeinu was in great danger for coming back. But as soon as he died, which was when he was 40 years old, and we Chazal in fact say that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he fled after killing the Egyptian, he was actually 40 years old. And that ties in precisely in the time of the death of Pepi the First, is when Moshe Rabbeinu came back, because the Pharaoh, who knew who he really was, had died. And once, after he killed the Egyptian and it was given over to the Pharaoh's, Pepi I's son, Pepi II. So Pepi II was out to kill him. And so he fled again. And once again, 39 years later, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu in Midian that the king who has tried to kill you, the people who have tried to kill you, and the posuk refers beforehand was Pharaoh who tried to kill him, have died. And in fact, that Pharaoh, Pepi II, died just that time. And the new Pharaoh, his son, Nefekeh, was the one who now became the king, and he was the Pharaoh throughout the 10 plagues which Moshe Rabbeinu dealt with.
So I guess this works better with the pshat of Yoko Melech Chodosh means Chodosh Mamish then.
Yes, I mean, in fact, everything is true, that the Midrashic explanation and the literal explanation all come into one.
Right. Okay. So that's him. We'll get back to me a little bit in a minute, but I want to pull back. So this week's parasha, Parashas Mikates, we're holding by Yosef, and it was gets pulled out of jail by the Pharaoh with the dream. So who was he? Have you been able to find out who was this one?
Yes. Basically, just following naturally back, since we've discovered that basically the Egyptian dynasties, beginning from the first dynasty, goes all the way up to the end of the sixth dynasty. So we follow back Egyptian history from the sixth dynasty, from the end of the sixth dynasty, from the time of the Pharaoh, going back the 210 years to the time when Yaakov Avinu came down with Bnei Yisrael. That takes us to the end of the fifth dynasty. The name of the king was Jed. In fact, this harmonizes with Sefer Yuchsim, who says that the king of Yosef, at the time of Yosef, his name was Jen. So Jen and Jed are very, very similar. Again, another piece of information which also corroborates that is the prime minister of this king, Jed, referred to by Egyptian sources, lived for 110 years. And we know that the Apostle tells us that Yosef lived for 110 years, and he was the prime minister. Again, the name of that is actually a similar construction of Yosef's Fahotef. Yahosef is a similar phonetic construction as the name of that prime minister. And so those are the king at the time of Yosef. But we also have more information that Sedra Doris tells us that at this week's Sedra, at the time when Yosef is brought to Paro, he actually proved to Paro the truth of his interpretation of the dream by telling him that a child is going to be born to him on that very day. And indeed, a child was born to him, the next Pharaoh. Now, this is very fascinating because we find that in the Pesukim tells us that Yosef was referred to, he refers himself to as Av Lefaro. He was a father to Pharaoh. Now, this now fits in very well. Basically, Jen at the time was getting very old and he was basically going into pension and he couldn't run the country anymore. His young son was not able to run the country. So Yosef, this was the time Yosef was taking over the country and basically looking after the whole of the empire on behalf of this young Pharaoh. Now, if it turned out that actually the Egyptian sources tells us that there was a king in ancient times who, in basically around the fifth and sixth dynasty, who actually reigned for 94 years. It's the only king in the whole of recorded history who reigned for such a long period of time. Now, this actually fits in very nicely with the son of Jen, of the Pharaoh at the time of Yosef with the dream, because if this young king became king at the beginning of the years of famine, he would have been 6 years old at the time when the beginning of the years of famine. In the beginning of the years of famine, we know that the second year after that, the Yaakov came down with Klal Yisrael, with Bnei Yisrael to Egypt. Chazal tell us, Seiron tell us, 94 years later, Vayokom Melech Chodosh Amitzrayim. That was the beginning of the Golas. So we have a period of 94 years a period from the time when that child was born at 6 years old, when he'd be 6 years old, 94 years later was when he would have died, according to the record that he reigned for 94 years. So we have this a tremendous length of reign which synchronizes perfectly for the reign of the king of Yosef, who Yosef guided and was his upper chop as he was of the Pharaoh. And throughout that 94-year period, he was subservient to Yosef, and therefore Klal Yisrael was safe. Only once that king died, his name was Yunus, then the Golus began. It's a fascinating piece of information found by the researcher Jim Long recently, and the pyramid of Yunus. This is the son of Jie Adien, who reigned for, we're claiming, for the 94 years. In his period, he depicts starving foreigners coming to Egypt and receiving their food, which is exactly what this king did. And that we know from the Gemara in Sota that after the year, after Yaakov Avinu died, famine actually came back. So it'd be this king, this young king, who would be having to feed the nations of the world. Another fascinating inscription of this king in the pyramid of this king Yunus, a very fascinating inscription where he refers to the one whose name is kept secret, and the time of the future of the slaying of the firstborn. And that seems to indicate the name of the Almighty, which we know is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is saying his name. We can't pronounce the Shem Hashem. The name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is kept secret. And there's a reference here to a future prophetic vision of the slaughtering of the firstborns in Egypt, which suggests that perhaps Yosef actually knew about the nevuah of the destruction of the firstborn. That seems to be an ikkah of the Exodus, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent Moshe Rabbeinu to Pharaoh. The first thing that Moshe Rabbeinu says, he says to Paro, "I'm going to kill your firstborn." That was the ultimate makkah, and that was the gist of the whole of the Exodus. So, and we find a reference to the slaying of the firstborn at the time of Yunus, as it possibly indicated by Yosef to him, maybe perhaps as a warning to this king not to meddle with Klal Yisroel.
Absolutely fascinating. I just want to mention, so everything we've discussed is in the book. It's just the tip of the iceberg. There's much more, obviously, on the first part about the dating and the years, a little complicated at some parts, but it's all in there. And then, obviously, different names and different pharaoh who they were, all of this and more. There's some charts. It's all in there. So check out the book, which I'll link to. All the books are Mosaica Press, which is distributed by Feldheim. They both have on their website. So it's on Amazon, and people can get it at any farm store as well. So it's just one, you know, as we kind of wrap up, just one question I think that maybe people, this is, so why would this just, you know, matter practically for someone to actually read about? It's just because it's like historical, it's interesting to know who to, like, what would you tell someone if someone asked you that?
I think it's important to be able to see the impeccable accuracy of our sages. When we're confronted with the authentic scientific evidence, and there's a great volume of it, all synthesizing and harmonizing with the words of our sages, and that brings a tremendous chizuk, although many people know that. But there are many people who have questioned that, though with people who are not so affiliated with the great strength of our emunah. But even those who have, I think it does have a visual to see, and demonstration of the accuracy gives a tremendous chizuk to us and to our reverence into Divrei Chazal and the importance of the quest of finding the truth in all fields of research.
Right. Okay. Absolutely. That makes sense. So we referenced, obviously, we talked about the Pharaoh book and we talked about the missing years as well. So just to quickly mention the Harsinai book, it's something a little different. What was the, just the nutshell, just to tell people if they'd be interested in that book?
Well, basically what we did was we tried to follow using the psukim. The psukim are cryptically worded, and there's a tremendous amount of information which one can glean from the analysis of the various psukim and the way they have been addressed, guided obviously by Chazal, and of course modern day mapping, which is so crucial to be able to see a true map of the area, is such an eye opener, and which it's such a blessing which we have, which unfortunately in previous generations they didn't have. And the time of be able to ascertain the various locations of the Masoret of Klal Yisrael from Egypt to Har Sinai become very possible. And we discovered that each destination bound by Chazal, the exact, sometimes Chazal giving exact dimensions of the journeys, of the locations. And generally speaking, when Chazal do that, it's based on Masorah. And anything which is in Masorah is really untouchable. It is precise. It is passed down from Moshe, from Har Sinai. And one can see that the demonstration of how everything fits into place. And basically, I followed from one encampment to the other, and I was led to a place which incredibly has a name which still is called today Horeba, which is Horeb, which is the place where Har Sinai was. And in that area called Horeba, as an adjacent mountain, which is also called Mount Jebel means mountain in Arabic, which is basically the Hebrew of Horeb, Har Horeb, which is another name for Har Sinai. So the name and the area has been maintained for several thousand years up until this very date. Through satellite imagery, I've taken the measurements of the mountain and everything about the characteristics, and found precise harmonization with the Divrei Chazal and the Divrei Masorah. I'll just give you one piece of information. There's a medrash brought down by the Chanukah Satorah that the Har Sinai was actually 500 amos. The Rekev tells us Har Sinai was actually a mountain on top of another mountain. At Har Horeb was the mountain underneath, and Har Sinai was the mountain on top. We can actually measure the height of the mountain using modern technology of the contour lines of the particular mountain. So using satellite imagery, I basically ascertained the height of the mountain through contour line and discovered that the top mountain is precisely 500 amis. Now, the Chanukah Satorah actually says, why was it 500 amis? Because we're told that the highest mountain was 4 parsa, which is actually 64 times 500 amis. And the reason why that is because the Gemara tells us in Sota that a person should be humble, but he has to have a shminish b'shminis of gaiva. He has to have 1/64th of gaiva. So the Chanukah Satorah said that's why Har Sinai was given on a mountain. It wasn't given in a valley. It was given on a mountain of 500 amos high, which is 1/64th of the highest mountain. And therefore, that's why Har Sinai was 500 amos. And lo and behold, we find that the Har Sinai today is exactly, precisely, it's still called Har Horeb, and it's 500 amos high.
Amazing. So people can definitely check out that book as well. And like I said, I'll link to all the books. One final thing of your recent that you worked on, you wrote an article in Ami Magazine, the Rosh Hashanah edition, about, I think it was, right, the location of Gan Eden. Or was it Rosh Hashanah or Sukkot? I don't remember.
Yes, it's actually the Sukkot edition, because to do with Bereshis and the four rivers. Yes, it's a fascinating topic about the four rivers which came out from Gan Eden. And there are actually three rivers which are very well known. The Chidekel is still called today, and the Euphrates, the River Poras, the Gihon, we know by it was referred to as the Pishon, seeming to be the one which is missing. We know the other one, the Pishon, was the River Nile. So it's one river which we don't know, which is in question. And following the information which we have based on the Divrei Chazal and the Psukim, we were actually led to discover that the fourth river actually dried up, but it was actually the El Arish, what was once the river of Egypt, became the Nachal Mitzrayim. That's why we find that the same reference to the river at the time of Bereshis was referred to as the Nahar Mitzrayim, but at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, it was referred to Nahar Mitzrayim because it actually dried up, and that's what a Nahal is. It's a river or something which doesn't dry up. A Nahal is a once flowing river, but it's dried up, and it only becomes flowing once in the winter season, and that's why it was called a Nahal. It was El Arish, and actually flowed all the way from Gan Eden, which was actually located in a nutshell opposite Teman, which is actually the place opposite in Teman is called Eden, it's called Mifrat Eden. The location of Gan Eden evidently is just over there. That's where the river came out. It went along the Red Sea. That's why we can't see any signs of it. After discovering the location of Gan Eden, which is actually a volcanic region, it's a volcano, there's tremendous surprise in looking at the satellite photos, which I would advise anyone who can has the access to look. It's on the border of Eritrea. I think it's Volcano Nebo, I think that's the name of it. The picture, there's a picture that actually in ingrained into the ground of the, it's basically a volcano within a volcano. The bottom of the center volcano seems to take the form of the profile of the face of a woman. The woman with her hair neatly bound behind her head, which reminisces Chava. Next to that face, it's just the picture of the face, the profile of the face. Next to that is an ingrained sort of picture of an animal head with a tongue coming out as if reminiscing the Nochosh. The outer volcano actually is in the shape of the head of a man lying down, basically with his head bashed in. With just one eye, which seems to again reminisce Hevel. And the outer volcano is the profile of the face of a man with a horn coming out of the top of his head, which seems to reminisce Cain. So you've got all those images in one volcano site, which is tremendous because it's the precise area which we have been led to through the Psukim and the Divrei Chazal of Gan Eden.
Wow, very cool. I mean, those images were not included in the article, right? In the magazine?
No. But one can't print more than 5,000 copies of. It's using Google satellite imagery, and Google don't allow more than the production of 5,000 images.
Again,
it couldn't be published.
Right, so where again can people go look if they want it? What would be the spell? Can you spell it?
It's in the border of Eritrea with Ethiopia. It's the volcano, I think it's called Volcano, I think Nebo. I think it's the Volcano Nebo. It's on the border of Eritrea. It's just at the edge. It's just at the edge of the... on the edge of the Red Sea. In fact, the whole of the Red Sea, if you look at the whole of the Red Sea, basically the whole of the Red Sea is the two arms at the top, which is the Gulf of Aqaba and the Suez, and then the whole of the body of the Red Sea comes down and ends in an arrowhead. And if you take a look back, it actually is the shape of a sword, a double-sided sword with the two arms of the gulfs in the form of Shtei Kruvim. So we have the Cherv HaMisapeches, which is put on the eastern side of Gan Eden. So if you look at the, if you want to try and look at the actual place of Gan Eden, you have to look at the basically the middle of the arrowhead. Just go from the shore, basically off the shore, the closest volcano which you have. As far as I remember, it was Mount Nebo, the volcano Nebo. That's where to look.
Fascinating. So just to finish up, are there any current projects or future projects you're working on? Any books currently?
Yes. After finishing the Sinai book, we continue to try and locate the locations of the various encampments from Sinai until the Promised Land throughout the 40-year sojourn in the wilderness. And I must tell you, it's full of surprises. And hopefully it should be coming to the shop very soon.
Okay, great. Looking forward. So thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
My pleasure.